up to you. Be innovative if you like. Show me what you bring to the table. Little did I know I was going to regret that last statement. Hello, folks. How you doing? This is Keith Tyler bringing you the Mystery Hour right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. We all really appreciate you tuning in. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine, R.T. Lawton, brings us our first story, and it's called Recidivism. It's too bad there isn't a support group for hitmen in the same way that Alcoholics Anonymous is there for people who need to quit drinking. If there was, then I should be eligible in a few days for a one-month token. It's not that I get off on killing people or anything like that. I'd say it's more of the fact that there are some real insensitive types out there walking the streets without a care for other people's feelings or property, which means that sometimes I have a strong compulsion to take those particular idiots out of the picture. Permanently. Well, for the good of the community. Of course, getting paid for doing that kind of work as a career is always a bonus for me, but I don't accept jobs on good people as I see them. However, there have been times in the past when I did take someone out, and I did it just for myself, for free. Like I said, it's a compulsion I tend to have when people start acting ugly. But these days, I'm trying to break that primal urge altogether and lead the straight life with a straight job. The other problem I got is this homeless young teenage hoodlum going by the name of Leonardo, whom I caught trying to break into the old car I use for surveillance in my newly formed B. Thornton private investigations firm. It's a small business I set up to give me some legit income while my feet are set on walking the straight and narrow. Anyway, I didn't shoot the kid like I normally would have for attempting to break into my car. Instead, I made him a contract employee on a piecework basis, and now he's pressuring me for him to be able to join the firm. No way he gets in. This is a one-man firm. Plus, at this point, he's not aware of what my old profession was, nor the compulsion I sometimes feel. Bottom line, it ain't easy being me. I called the kid on the burner phone I gave him after his last job and told him where to meet me tonight. He had a half an hour to get there and ended up being 5 minutes early. I liked that. The kid showed eagerness, reliability, and best of all, he was pliable. I was standing at the trunk of my old surveillance car as he drove up the parking ramp. As soon as his headlights shined on me, he made a quick left, parked in one of the stalls, and killed the engine. I waited for him to come over, then opened my trunk. The trunk light came on, and it threw him for a moment. You got a body in there, he exclaimed. Looks that way, doesn't it? He dead? I hope so, I replied. Otherwise, we got real problems. You saying this isn't a problem? No, I think you can handle it. What am I supposed to do with him? Well, you want to work for me, right?
I thought so.
He paused. Maybe. Make up your mind. It's now or never.
You kill him?
No. A client of mine did. According to the client, he had no choice. It was him, pointing at the body in the trunk, or him. So the client did what he thought was best for himself. People tend to do that.
Okay. So are you going to do what's best for you?
He was taking too much time with this one, so I nudged him a little. Look, I don't have all night. Give me a yes or no. You in or out?
How much?
How much what?
Money, to take him off your hands. The client already gave me 4 figures worth to dispose of this guy, so I'll give you half of that. Which is how much? Man, standing around a parking lot at night, dickering over money with a corpse in the trunk, I don't need. If the cops rolled on us, the resulting shootout would make the late-night news, and all my good intentions of trying to lead the straight life would go straight to hell. It's a low 4 figures for your part, I said. Don't worry, you'll be amply compensated for the efforts. Okay, so what do you want me to dump him? That's up to you. Be innovative if you like. Show me what you bring to the table. Yeah, little did I know I was going to regret that last statement. I thought he'd go for a shallow hole in the woods, or maybe even a dumpster behind some business that didn't have those darn security cameras all over the premises. Oh, no such luck. Turned out the kid had a lively imagination. The client seemed somewhat upset when he called me the next day. At best, I'd say he was probably foaming at the mouth, like he'd just put too much toothpaste on his toothbrush. "You see the news this morning?" was his opening question. "Nope. What's up?" "You know that little job I paid you for in advance?" "Yeah, what's the problem?" "The cops found the guy already." "So what? The guy's deceased. He's not going to tell anybody anything. And you didn't say nothing to me about having him disappear forever. I thought you'd run him through a wood chipper or take him deep water swimming with a backpack full of rocks like you usually do. But no, you put him in the back seat of a police car with handcuffs on his wrist behind his back? Now the cops are going to work extra hard to prove it wasn't them that killed him." "So?" "So, I don't want them knocking on my door when they start to try to exonerate themselves." "What cause would they have to knock on your door?" "Well, because the guy used to work for me, that's why." "Well, if the guy used to work for you, then sooner or later they'd get around to talking with you anyway. You should have told me at the time you wanted him to disappear for keeps. We would have done it different." It got quiet for a minute, but I swear I could hear the client counting to himself in a low mumble. I was pretty sure he was all the way up to 10 or 12 before he got to whatever his mind was working on. Then, "We." "You said we. How many other people know about my business?"
"Nobody."
"You didn't park the guy's corpse in the cop car by yourself, did you?"
"No, I farmed the disposal job out to an associate, somebody new to the business. But he doesn't know who you are. Don't worry, I'll take care of it."
"You better take care of it permanently. I don't want this coming back on me. No repercussions, none. You got me?"
Yeah, I got you. I said I'll take care of it." Something didn't feel right here. I was going to have to look into the situation a little deeper, see what was going on. But first, I had to put a call into my so-called associate. Leonardo picked up on the third ring. "Leon, you know that little disposal job I gave you?" The kid started laughing.
"Yeah, pretty funny where they found him, huh? The news feeds are going to love that one. Puts the shoe on the other foot, so to speak."
"Doesn't make any difference what foot it's on. The client doesn't like the heat this situation will bring."
"What's the client got to worry about?"
Well, that was the question I was asking myself. "Look, I'll call you back later if I need you." Then I hung up. It was going to take 3 or 4 days before I could do what I wanted to do, but there was nothing for it now except to wait for events to follow their natural progression. On the day of the deceased funeral, I was laying on a spread-out sleeping bag between 2 marble headstones with a spotting scope on a tripod in front of me. Large floral displays on either side of me gave me some cover from the side, and since it appeared that this part of the cemetery was pretty well all filled in, There shouldn't be any pesky cemetery employees showing up here to dig new graves and ask embarrassing questions about what I was doing. Other than that, I just had to hope for the best. Turned out, it wasn't my day.
What are you looking at?
Inquired a little voice. Crap. Busted. Now what? Slowly I turned around to see a young boy. I put him about 9 or 10 years old. Strangely enough, he had a cigar in one hand. What do you think I'm doing?
Well, I don't know. What are you doing?
This little talk wasn't going anywhere. Time for me to change the subject. What are you doing with that cigar? You're too young to smoke.
My dad always liked a good cigar, so I'm bringing him one.
I took a quick glance around to see if anyone else was sneaking up on me. Nothing. Nobody. So where's your dad? The kid pointed at the tombstone on my left.
You're lying right beside him.
I scooted over a little to my right. Sorry about that. I didn't know.
Yeah, that's okay. He doesn't get much company up here except when I drop by to visit him and bring a cigar.
I could tell the kid wasn't going away anytime soon, yet I needed to be looking through that spotting scope to watch what was going on down at the internment. It wasn't like I could just show up graveside in person for the ceremony. People would ask questions, plus the cops were probably keeping their own eye on this little gathering down the slope. So where's your mother? I finally asked. She here too?
Yeah. She's over the hill behind us visiting her dead sister. I'm supposed to meet back up with Mom in about half an hour. She says I don't need to be hanging around while she discusses whatever it is she talks with her floozy sister.
Tell me something, kid. You even know what a floozy is?
Nope. Just that my mom is mad at her sister about something that happened just before Dad died.
I see. At this point, I wasn't about to ask what it was that dear Dad died from. Plus, I wasn't normally a morning person anyway, not even after a couple of mugs of eye-opening coffee.
So what are you looking at through the scope? Inquired the kid.
Birds. I'm just watching birds.
What kind of birds?
The kid wouldn't let up. I made claws out of my fingers and showed my teeth in a grimace. Big, mean birds, I said. Vultures, the kind that eat little kids.
Well, let me see, he exclaimed.
Before I could stop him, the kid slid next to me on the sleeping bag and was peering through the spotting scope.
I don't see nothing down there but people standing next to a hole in the ground. One of them's a boy like me.
He started to wave at the funeral party. I doubted there was another kid anywhere like this shyster who right now was way too close to me. Quickly, I yanked his arm down in mid-wave. Careful, kid. You'll scare the vultures away and they won't come back.
I didn't see no vultures, he said. Only some man in a black suit and red tie giving that boy down there a $20 bill.
Oh, there's vultures down there, kid. You just need a sharp eye to pick them out. From what I'd seen earlier, the guy wearing the red tie was my unhappy client in the body disposal incident. But why was he giving the boy at graveside a $20 bill? Unless he had a guilty conscience about what happened? Nope, that didn't sound like him. We'd known each other quite well in the old days, when he had hired me for a few jobs to correct problems in his criminal organization. But the more I considered the situation, the more I thought maybe some of the money I'd gotten from him 4 days ago might be the answer to my immediate problem, the little kid who was hogging my spotting scope. I stuck my hand in my pants pocket and pulled out my money clip. I tell you what, kid, how about I give you $20 bill and you go see if your mother's ready to go home yet? My mistake was letting the little shyster see that I had more money than we'd originally been talking about. He stared at me for a couple of heartbeats, then at the money clip, as if he were mentally counting the bills and contemplating how much he could harvest. How about $30? I didn't see any advantage to try to negotiate with this miniature con man, so I peeled off a 20 and a 10 and handed them to him. "Now beat it," I said.
"Sure," he replied. "I'll leave you alone with your invisible vultures."
As he wandered off over the hill, I started to wonder how much of a vulture he'd grow up to be. With him gone, I turned back to the spotting scope. Seems the guy in the red tie was just then removing his hand from the rump of the widow and waving one of his henchmen over to take the young woman's son in hand and remove him far enough away so as not to interfere with my client's plan. With the young son out of the way, my client's hand returned to the rump. The rest of the group couldn't see what was going on because it was all behind the widow's back, and she didn't appear to be doing anything about it. From my position, I couldn't tell if she was okay with all of this surreptitious attention, or if she was just numb from the recent loss of her husband. Either way, it gave me something to think about. Plus, knowing the actions of my client in his prior life, I was pretty sure what his future intentions were when it came to the widow. I swiveled the spotting scope slightly over to the dead guy's kid. He had dropped the $20 bill on the ground like it meant nothing to him. Instead, he was crying his eyes out when my client's henchman kept a tight grip on the collar of the kid's suit jacket to keep him from returning to his mother. That was enough for me. Time to go. I rolled up my sleeping bag, picked up the spotting scope, and took a walk before anyone else showed up to pay their respects to the dearly departed. Who knew cemeteries had so much life going on? A couple of days later, I called Leonardo again. "Hey, you available?" "I could be. What do you need?" "Meet me same place as last time, half an hour." "You got a job for me? If you're up to it." "What's it pay?" "Oh, geez, here we go again." "You take American dollars, right?" "Yeah? Well, then you'll be satisfied. Now get over here." "On my way." Once again, the kid was 5 minutes early. I couldn't help but like him for his eagerness, even if he had a materialistic streak. I was in the same spot in the parking garage. As soon as he saw me, he pulled into a parking place a couple of spaces from mine and killed his engine. I walked over his car, leaned against his trunk, and waited for him to get out. "Hey, what you need me to do?" he asked. "I got something in my trunk." "It's not another dead body, is it? You kind of surprised me last time with that corpse." "Nope, it's not a dead body." "Well, okay then." I put my hand up to stop him from walking over to my car just yet. "Let's talk about a few things first. Is this about me leaving the dead guy in the cop car?" "Yes and no." "Hey, man, I'm sorry if it caused you any trouble. You said to be innovative, and I was driving around the street, and there was this cop car parked at the curb with its rear passenger door open and no cops in sight, so I told myself, why not? I thought it was funny." "Yeah, about that." The grin slid off his face. "Oh, I hope I didn't get you into too much trouble with your client." "Yeah, no sweat there. We had some words, but I think the client and I are going to get this whole thing worked out between us." "Good," replied Leonardo. "So, what did you want to talk to me about?" "You're working for me, but I don't know anything about your background. So, ask me something. I was wondering how you ended up homeless. You never talk about your father." "Yeah, that's because he deserted Mom and me when I was about 8 or 9. After a while, Mom couldn't afford the house payments, so the bank foreclosed on it, and we ended up living in our car. Then Mom got sick and died when the hospital wouldn't take her without health insurance. Only thing I had left was the car." "How old were you by then?" "About 15 when she passed." "You think your life would have been different if your father had stuck around?" "Oh, you know it would have been." "Would you say he deserves killing for ruining you and your mom's future, giving you guys a hard life by his leaving?" "Well, when you put it like that, I'd say heck yes." "Did you ever catch up with him later in life?" "No.
I got close a couple of times, but he had moved on just before I got there. Now it's a moot point.
Oh, why is that?
I heard that Dad was having a late-night drunk in the neighborhood bar when two armed robbers tried to stick it up. Turned out the bartender had his own weapon because it was a bad neighborhood. Dad got caught in the crossfire. So every year, on my birthday, I have a beer at his grave and water the grass growing above him.
I nodded my head as I thought about his words and his situation.
Thanks, Leon. I appreciate your candor.
He looked at me kind of funny for a short while before asking his own question.
Okay, so you got me out here late at night, so what's the job?
I held up my left index finger.
Wait here. I'll be right back.
Then I walked to my car, opened the rear passenger door, took a shovel and a pickaxe out of the back seat and carried them over to the back of Leonardo's car.
Here, put these in your trunk.
Hey, what for?
'Cause you'll need them.
He was going to ask me what for question again, but he caught himself and cocked his head to one side like he was listening to something.
You hear a noise?
I glanced around and pretended to listen for whatever he thought he had heard.
No, nothing. Probably just your engine cooling down.
Nah, sounds more like a thumping noise than it does metal contracting.
Don't worry about it. We got business to do.
I think he could tell I was riding a little bit on edge. He did as I requested and slammed the trunk lid a little harder than necessary before he returned to his favorite subject.
How much?
$1,000.
To do what?
Oh, it's nothing illegal, I said. Then I reached in my jacket pocket, removed a folded packet, and handed him 10 $100 bills wrapped in a hand-drawn map.
Follow the directions on the map, I said, and when you get to the X, I want you to dig a hole so I can bury something large.
When you're finished, leave the shovel and pick at the side of the hole and go home, wherever you park your car these days, and have a beer. Know that you did your country a service.
He tried to prolong our conversation, but I moved him right along to the driver's side of his car, opened the door for him, and bundled him into the seat.
Best get moving, I said. We don't have much time before sunrise.
I waited until he drove out of the parking garage and started walking toward my vehicle. On the way, I took out my .22 caliber automatic out of the back of my belt and screwed on the suppressor. At the rear of the car, I stuck the key in the slot and opened the trunk. I hadn't lied to my teenage hoodlum associate. There was no dead body in the trunk. However, as soon as the trunk lid opened, a gagged and bound figure raised up. The man, still in his underwear, wriggled like crazy trying to get out of the trunk. A quick lead slug in his right thigh quieted down his escape motions and got me his attention. I took a seat at the rear of the open car trunk and clicked the safety on my automatic to on. My old client in the trunk appeared a little relieved, like he'd just gotten a reprieve of some sort.
My associate, I said, will be busy for a while, so we have some time for a little chat.
He nodded his head vigorously, then stuck his chin out like he wanted me to remove the duct tape from across his mouth.
I shook my head in the negative, and he started working his jaws like he had something to say. Problem was, I wasn't going to rip off the tape because this was intended to be a one-sided conversation. No interruptions.
I'll go first, I said.
My associate and I conferred, and we both agreed that a young kid needs his dad while he's growing up. It makes a big difference as to how a young boy ends up in life. And you, well, you murdered a kid's dad because you lusted after the man's wife. I am really disappointed in you.
He shook his head as if denying the charge.
I clicked the safety to off.
In actuality, I was disappointed, but it was more to the fact that I realized I was about to backslide on my good intentions. There would be no one-month token for me.
Yeah, I'd have to start all over again from day one, damn. Living with this recidivism, It was going to be a real problem. Okie doke. I'm switching to the June issue of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine, a story this time by Kevin Egan, and it's called Buds. Fox sat in the empty jury box, dividing his attention between the Daily News racing page and the characters scattered around the courtroom. Natalie dressed Duke Casale and SCO Ray McCaffrey sat at one end of the counsel's table, dealing out endless hands of gin rummy. The regal Shiona sat at the opposite end, swiping her phone while SCO Hilly Blitzer hovered at her shoulder, his head bobbing to a song playing in his earbuds. The two opposing legal teams took turns pacing along the gallery rail and occasionally pairing off to discuss whatever lawyers discussed while a jury determined their clients' fates. In the gallery, a couple dozen star-struck adolescents lucky enough to snag seats at the start of the day's proceedings whispered and fidgeted. Suddenly a buzz jolted the courtroom. Duke and Ray folded their hands. Shiona dropped her phone and groped for Hilly's wrist. The lawyers stopped pacing. The gallery froze. Fox, the sole person in the courtroom obligated to react, calmly closed his newspaper and exited the courtroom through the jury entry door. Half a flight up, the jury room door opened just enough for a hand to reach out with an envelope. Fox descended the stairs and, rather than entering the courtroom, barged into the robing room where Judge Bauman, Boomerang Betty, as she was known for her head-spinning changes of mind, whispered into her phone. She cut the call at the intrusion and stared daggers over her half-glasses. "Jury note," said Fox. The judge instantly relaxed. She took the envelope from Fox's hand and tore it open. "Get me the lawyers," she said. Fox opened the courtroom door. The lawyers snapped to attention. "Jury note," said Fox. All six lawyers filed into the robing room and arranged themselves in a semicircle in front of the judge's desk. "The jury has reached a verdict," said Judge Bauman. She let the news sink in for a moment. "So it is now or never. Are you going to settle this mishigas of a case, or do you still insist on rolling the dice?" Fox found it hard to believe 6 weeks had passed since he climbed out of the subway station and into an unusual amount of activity for Foley Square on a Tuesday morning in mid-July. A small city of SUVs with satellite uplinks surrounded the black marble fountain. Correspondents stood before cameras, reporting the latest developments to the morning news anchors back in the studios. Across Center Street, a mob gathered at the foot of the courthouse steps. Several court officers guarded a set of metal stanchions hurriedly erected to shunt the mob away from the two brass handrails that funneled foot traffic up to the courthouse portico. As Fox approached, the mob came into focus. It was made up solely of adolescent girls waving signs and chanting a single name, Shiona. "Duke Casale and some pop singer," said Captain Kearney when Fox reported to the security post, where the entire contingent of court officers signed in at the start of each day. "Apparently he's a former child actor turned talent manager. She's a singer with a fan base too young to drive. Know them?" Fox shook his head. He never heard of Duke Casale or Shiona, or if he had, their names hadn't lodged in any of his brain cells as they flitted through his consciousness. "They were an item," said Kearney.
And then they weren't, and now they are fighting over millions based on a personal services contract the judge tells me is of dubious validity. Their people asked us to provide special security during the trial.
People? Said Fox.
Lawyers, PR firms, recording company execs, concert promoters, I'm assigning an office to each of them. I need you to take point on this.
Who are you assigning? Said Fox.
The only two available, said Kearney. Ramack and Hilly B.
He made the sign of the cross.
The meeting occurred on the same day as the final pretrial conference. While Boomerang Betty summoned the lawyers and litigants into the robing room to extol the virtues of settlement, Fox and his team met with Duke and Shiona's people in the jury deliberation room. If the case did proceed to trial, as it likely would, since neither side showed any inclination to settle, there were ground rules to define, decisions to make, protocols to establish. Duke and Shiona each had their own security team, but as Fox explained, private security was forbidden to operate on court property. The handoffs, each morning and each evening, would occur at the rear entrance, which would be cordoned off from the general public at the appropriate times. Inside the courthouse, the two officers were not to let their charges out of their sight. With the logistics decided, there was only one issue to resolve. Who would guard whom? Fox faced a daunting choice. Ray was famous for boarding a flight to Acapulco for a week's vacation wearing only a tank top and swim trunks and carrying only a towel. Closer to home, he numbered among his romantic conquests lawyers, litigants, clerks, other court officers, and, if he could be believed, the occasional judge. Assigning him to Shiona could result in harassment charges. Then there was Hilly, who lived with his two cats and left his Brooklyn neighborhood only to catch the number 4 train to the courthouse. He barely spoke above a whisper, rarely contributed to locker room banter, and was rumored to be a virgin. Assigning him to Duke would be like creating a vaudeville team without the comedy. Luckily, Ray volunteered to take Duke. Each day at 9 a.m. sharp, Fox waited with Ray and Hilly at the rear entrance. Duke usually arrived first, blazered, open-collared, and sockless, product in his hair and designer glasses framing his face in a blatant attempt to soften his wolfish aspect into something benignly studious. Shiona always arrived after Duke, and Ray disappeared into the courthouse, sometimes fashionably late, other times tardy enough to evoke the judge's ire. Shiona's wardrobe ranged from ultra-casual to red carpet formal. Her hair, which Fox learned was her signature style point, never looked the same way twice. Intricate cornrows, lengthy extensions, massive blowouts. She would follow Hilly into the courthouse, and as slowly as Hilly shuffled, she sashayed even more slowly, prompting Hilly to glance repeatedly over his shoulder as if expecting her to disappear. The trial was as tedious as most trials Fox had witnessed, and the 24 spectators admitted from the daily mob at the courthouse steps usually gave up their gallery seats in utter boredom at the mid-morning break. Rather than salacious stories and showbiz gossip, the evidence involved testimony from dueling accountants, overhead projections of incomprehensible spreadsheets, and abstruse explanations of generally accepted accounting principles. Even worse, this dry evidence took hours to present and even more hours for the jury to digest, which caused Boomerang Betty to kick off every session by herding counsel and clients into her robing room and exhorting them to settle. "You're both losing this jury," she warned.
Neither side budged.
Fox, meanwhile, observed the interactions between his team and their charges. People like Duke and Shiona were accustomed to being pampered, idolized, indulged.
spending days on end in a dusty courthouse on a boring trial with little control over even their most basic bodily functions, like eating or using the lavatory, was bound to wear on their nerves. And under these circumstances, to whom could they turn other than to the two people assigned to protect them? Even in less extreme circumstances, Fox had seen relationships arise between litigants and court staff, jurors and court staff, sometimes even lawyers and court staff. Most of these relationships were harmless, innocent, and temporary. A few had turned problematic, but none had been Fox's official concern. Within the first week, Duke and Ray began to act like a couple of buds. They high-fived on arrival in the morning, bro-hugged at departure in the evening, and in between talked animatedly as if swapping war stories, the war most likely waged against women. Shiona and Hilly started out like two reluctant teens on a blind date. They spoke little and rarely made eye contact. At the start of the third week, during the luncheon process, Fox came upon Hilly sitting outside a vacant office tucked away in one of the many alcoves created by the complicated courthouse floor plan.
She's inside, said Hilly, plucking an earbud from one ear. She want a tie for lunch. I ran out to that restaurant on Baxter.
He smiled.
She likes it. A lot.
After that, Fox observed signs of a burgeoning relationship. He could detect genuine warmth in Shiona's smile at the handoff in the morning, and a hint, though only a hint, of wistfulness in Hilly's eyes at the handoff in the evening. At lunchtime, when Fox passed by that vacant office, Hilly's guard chair was unoccupied. Fox could hear voices inside. At the start of the fourth week of the trial, Kearney summoned Fox to his office.
Word's going around that Hilly is falling for this Shiona, he said.
Yeah, I've seen some signs, said Fox.
Word's also going around that it's reached the point of embarrassment, said Kearney. He's wearing these little white things in his ears. Apparently she gave them to him as a gift so he could listen to her music. He's now challenging anyone who says an unkind word about her. Almost came to blows in the locker room.
I heard. Okay, I'll talk to him, said Fox. The afternoon session was scheduled to end at 3 p.m., which gave Fox time to speak to Hilly before close of business. They agreed to meet in a park across from the courthouse. Fox was intentionally late, which allowed him a few moments to observe Hilly from afar. Hilly was hunched over on the park bench with his elbows on his knees and his hands figuratively pulling petals off of an invisible daisy. Fox settled beside him.
"I sense a connection developing between you and Shiona," he said.
"You do?"
said Hilly, biting off a hint of a smile. "Yeah, so does Kearney. So do a lot of other officers."
"Those jerks," said Hilly.
Fox summoned his most baleful stare.
Okay, I didn't really mean that, said Hilly. She's a nice person, and she's kind of, well, alone in this. She has her lawyers, but they're not her lawyers, because she didn't hire them. Her record company did, and Duke, well, you know, he split with her ages ago, so she has no one to confide in, except she started to confide in me. She had all the talent. Duke had some connections, but not many. It was a good deal for both of them at first, but the bigger she got, the less he did, and the more he took.
Well, it's not exactly what's come out from the evidence I've heard, said Fox.
Yeah, well, he's the plaintiff, so all we've heard in this case so far is that. Wait till her case goes on.
The talk had no effect on Hilly. On a granular level, Hilly's body language, facial expressions, even his tone of voice seemed like those of a man experiencing wild emotional gyrations.
Sometimes, when everyone else in the courtroom concentrated on the testimony coming from the witness stand, Hilly stared at Shiona with the confidence of a lover. At other times, like during a brief recession between witnesses, Hilly fumbled around like a nervous sophomore in the presence of a high school prom queen. On the macro level, Hilly continued to lock Shiona into that vacant office, run out and fetch lunch, then lock himself into the office with her. Fox had no clue to what they might be talking about, since Hilly had no obvious interests, hobbies, knowledge base, or even just the personality to engage someone with the lifestyle and background of Shiona. Nice guys like Hilly didn't always finish last. They often didn't finish at all. And someone like Shiona could be totally transactional in her relationships. Eventually, the trial would end, and Hilly would come spiraling in for a bumpy landing. At the start of the sixth week of the trial, Boomerang Betty summoned Hilly, Ray, and Fox into her roaming room. It was immediately obvious to Fox, from the way the judge zeroed in on Hilly and Ray, that his own presence at the meeting was a mere courtesy. "I have never done this before," said the judge, "ever, but I am literally at my wit's end trying to beat some sense into their two heads. I want this case to settle. I need this case to settle. They should need and want to settle too, but it just hasn't happened. You two have spent more time with them than anyone. Do either of you have any idea what I can say to get through to these two meshuggahna?" Ray stared blankly. Hilly tittered at the Yiddish reference. They both shook their heads. "You're certain about this?" said the judge. "Yes, ma'am," they said in unison. "Nothing?" said the judge. "No, ma'am." The judge drummed her fingers on her desk, watching the two officers get up and return to the courtroom. Fox stayed behind. "Keep an eye on them," said Boomerang Betty. "That rakish one. He's thick as thieves with that horrible Duke. And that little nebbish, he's obviously lovesick over Shiona." Testimony ended on a Thursday, and Boomerang Betty scheduled summations and charge for the next day. All the players and a host of teenage spectators arrived early in that morning, and the judge dug into a last-ditch effort to force a settlement. First, she met with all the lawyers, then with Duke and his legal team, then with Shiona and her team. Fox manned the roving room door, ushering the opposing forces in and out. He didn't listen to any of the confabs, but he could read the mounting frustration on Boomerang Betty's face as the minutes crawled past and nothing, at least from her idiosyncratic point of view, was accomplished. Finally, after Duke and his crew exited for the third time, she stood up from her desk, zipped up her robe to the Peter Pan collar, and told Fox to seat the jury. The two summations and the jury charge lasted an hour and a half, after which Fox escorted the jury to the deliberating room. He gave them all the usual instructions, took their lunch orders, and acquainted them with the buzzer, which would be their only means of communication with the outside world until they reached a verdict. Back in the courtroom, people settled in for a long wait. Hilly sat off Shiona's shoulder, the earbuds dangling and his head bobbing, while he tried his best not to stare as she swiped endlessly on her phone. At the opposite corner of counsel's table, Duke broke out a deck of cards and played gin rummy with Ray. Neither seemed much interested in the games. The lawyers huddled separately. On occasion, the judge peeked out of the roving room, hoping to see some evidence of movement between the parties. She saw nothing. At 2:45, the buzzer sounded. Fox had seen this scenario many times. Only a small percentage of the 30,000-plus cases filed in Manhattan Supreme Court each year ever went to trial. and only a minuscule amount of the cases that went to trial proceeded all the way to the verdict. Cooler heads usually prevailed. Whether because a few days on trial had sufficiently padded the attorney's fees, or because the eyes and ears of the total strangers in the jury box convinced the litigants that their cases were, well, crap. And so it seemed with the multi-million-dollar case of Duke Casale versus Shiona. Before the judge could mount the bench to say that the jury had reached a verdict, the lawyers were banging on the robing room door. "We have a settlement," they announced. The robing room was crowded. There was Boomerang Betty, Duke, Shiona, their six lawyers, the court stenographer, and, since courthouse regulations required the presence of a court officer, Fox. The terms of the settlement were to remain sealed, and by its explicit terms prohibited both Duke and Shiona from disclosing those terms to anyone other than their people. From what Fox could glean, neither party would contest the validity of the contract, but in the interest of ending the dispute, Duke would relinquish his claim and pay Shiona a percentage of her counterclaim. The percentage totaled $4 million. After the settlement was placed on the record, the judge dismissed the jury with the thanks of the court. The lawyers packed their litigation bags and rolled out to the corridor. Duke and Shiona traded an icy handshake. Fox led the way to the rear entrance for the final handoff. Duke and Ray bro-hugged with thumping backslaps. Shiona and Hilly embraced warmly, nuzzling each other's cheeks, then squirming into a real kiss. In a final flourish, Hilly pried off his earbuds and handed them to Shiona. Nothing Fox observed during the final handoff bothered him until 3 a.m., the next morning when he bolted awake. He arrived at the courthouse an hour early the next morning and headed directly to Boomerang Betty's jury deliberation room. He wasn't sure exactly what he was looking for, and he wasn't sure exactly what he found, even after he peeled off the tiny silver disc from under a bookshelf. "Where'd you find this?" said the tech in the MIS department. "A friend found it," Fox lied. "In his apartment." "Is your friend under surveillance?" said the tech. Fox shrugged. "Any idea of its range?" "Well, long enough that I wouldn't want to find it in my apartment," said the tech. Fox sat on the discovery for a few weeks. What he knew was enough to persuade the DA to file charges against Shiona and Hilly for perpetrating a fraud on the court, maybe even jury tampering. Was that result truly worth the trouble? As Boomerang Betty had explained to the jury, litigants are rarely happy about the settlement, but that is the price they pay for determining their own fate rather than trusting to the whims of a jury or the dictates of an appellate court. In fact, Fox would have sat on his discovery forever if Kearney hadn't broken the news about Hilly. "Yeah, he put in his retirement papers yesterday," said Kearney. "Cleaned out his locker this morning. You can catch him before he leaves the building if you hurry." Fox rushed down to the lobby, then out onto the portico. Down below, the sidewalk was crowded with pedestrians, and Center Street was jammed with its usual slow-moving uptown traffic. Across the street, on the edge of the park, Hilly sat on a bench with a suitcase between his feet. He was still sitting on the bench, eyes transfixed on some middle distance, when Fox eased down beside him. "Loan me the earbuds so I can listen to her songs off her phone during the breaks," he said. "It wasn't my type of stuff, but I got to like it." Fox slipped the bug out of his pocket and placed it on the bench between them. "Oh," said Hilly. They sat for several minutes listening to the traffic. It was her idea, but she needed me to bring it off. First, she needed me to hide this in the jury room. Hilly flipped the bug like a coin and snatched it out of the air. Next, she wanted me to listen with the earbuds she gave me. She said I would understand what the jury was talking about, but actually I think she didn't want to hear what the jurors thought about her, which was wise because they didn't think much of either of them. They thought Duke was a chauvinist at best and a misogynist at worst. Her, well, he lifted his head and looked down his nose. But I gotta say, none of that entered into the jury's deliberations. First thing they did was nullify the contract. Then they no-caused both of them on their claim and counterclaims. She was hoping for $12 million, but what I heard convinced her to take the $4 million Duke was offering to settle.
And now? Said Fox.
Well, she has a place in Colorado, said Hilly. Can't imagine what it's like out there, but I guess I'll find out.
Fox nudged Hilly's suitcase with his toe. That's all you're taking?
Well, I'll need, said Hilly.
What time is she picking you up?
An hour ago, said Hilly. But you remember how late she always was getting to court.
They shook hands, wished each other well, and said their goodbyes. Fox crossed Center Street and climbed the front steps to the portico. At the top, he looked back down as a black car stopped in front of Hilly's bench. Hilly got up with his suitcase and leaned down to the driver's window. After some words, the black car pulled away and melted into the uptown traffic. Hilly settled back down on the bench, his head in his hands. All right, folks, in our last very few final minutes of our episode today, I'm going to read to you again from that Alfred Hitchcock Mystery Magazine from their Story That Won department, the story written by Bethany Linder to the picture that they've published here a month or two ago. Picture's a blank wall, but in front of it, in a big tight cluster, looks like there's probably 2 or 3 dozen balloons. Some are floating up above just a little bit, the rest are in a big knot, resting on the floor. The story is called Inflated Expectations.
Well, I ignore Doug's bellow. Nothing unusual there. It's the popping sounds, like firecrackers, which cause me to poke my head above the cubicle.
More sounds and pops emanate from his office.
Yeah, best to avoid him today, Vicky says, leaning over the cubicle wall. What's going on?
We duck down as the tyrant emerges. He barks orders at several employees, including one for Paige to get this crap out of his office. My teammates jump to obey as he storms off. Vicky springs back up, so I ask, where's Anna?
Saint Anna, as we call her, holds the 10-year record as Doug's executive assistant. 16 months. He treats the position like a servant. In addition to professional duties, he's ordered Anna to book his personal travel, schedule his doctor's appointments, return items he bought, and other tasks deemed beneath him.
Gone, Vicky chuckles. She was at her son's baseball game Saturday when he called. He demanded she leave to pick up his dry cleaning. She refused. He threatened to write her up for insubordination, telling her that the job is so easy any clown could do it.
Vicky scans the area, ensuring we're alone.
She called me after coming to the office yesterday. She placed her resignation letter on his desk along with a red nose and clown shoes before stuffing his office full of balloons.
I kept quiet, choosing not to share that Anna once told me of Doug's severe latex allergy.
Well, perhaps she forgot.
Almost sounds like clown music. All right, wonderful people, that's going to do it for the Mystery Hour. This time, thanks for tuning in, and thanks for tuning in to Sun Sounds of Arizona. Keith Tyler here asking you to join me again next time, would you please? I'd appreciate it. Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.